fighting for America.
You've got tremendous love for this country, Kevin, and the people of Idaho. And anybody that has had a chance to be able to get to know you, even just listening to you on the radio, knows you got a heart of gold, man. And we all appreciate it.
Fighting for Idaho.
Hey, thanks again, Kevin, and thanks, Cadio. You know, we appreciate you and the community, obviously. Appreciate you guys all the time. I'm just another one.
Fighting for you.
Everybody isn't Kevin Miller, and I'm not just saying this. I've said this behind your back. You are one of the best in the entire country. I know that for a fact. But you are an exception, sadly, a big exception to what our industry has become.
Boise's Mr. Right, Kevin Miller in the morning.
Well, Heidi, the check's in the mail for that one.
On 580 KIDO, Idaho's first radio station.
Kevin Miller in the morning, 580 KIDO. Joining us now, attorney Effley Bailey, co-author of Excellence in Cross-Examination. Mr. Bailey, it's an honor to have you with us here, sir.
Thank you.
You know, when we talk about the art of the cross-examination, it's always pumped up in movies. It's always pumped up in TV. How realistic is the popular media perception of what really happens in the courtroom?
There have been several movies where it was really well done. Most of them are trash. I mean, they simply break every rule in the book to get dramatic effect. But there are some movies like To Kill a Mockingbird and Anatomy of a Murder where it was done pretty much according to the book. And it's a trick to keep cross-examination interesting because if you're doing it properly, there are spots where it's going to be very dull.
Mr. Bailey, why does everybody want to be a lawyer?
Well, I haven't figured that out because it's not the finest life in the world. It presents a lot of difficulties and cutthroat competition and playing close to the edge of the cliff. I did not recommend any of my sons be lawyers, and if I had to do it over again, I have grave doubts that I would seek that end of the road. However, I must point out that when I wanted to be a lawyer back in the 50s, it was a whole different and, to my mind, much more pleasant ballgame.
Well, a lot of folks may not know that you were a Marine aviator, and once a Marine, always a Marine. Did that help you in the courtroom, sir?
It did, because too many lawyers have been timid at times when they needed to strike boldly forth. And Marines tend to be afraid of very little, if anything. And so if there were an opportunity that took a little bit of chutzpah, I would likely march into the fray. And often I would get my head clobbered, but more often I would wind up with some kind of score. And, you know, you can't tell what's under a rock unless you lift it.
Excellence in Cross-Examination, Effley Bailey with Kevin Miller here at 580 KIDO. Can we learn anything from the art of cross-examination and how to deal with people at work or, you know, how to settle disagreements in our own life?
The book was intended to reach a very wide audience, not just lawyers, but witnesses, particularly expert witnesses, people that are thinking of getting into litigation. It will show them the uncertainty of the outcome and also the scarcity of really good trial lawyers out there and some checklists by which to make sure you get one because they're hard to get. On the other hand, if you do have a very good, well-prepared trial lawyer, it immeasurably increases your chances of winning the case. So it's worth doing. That's what the book is all about. It really is a pathway to excellence in cross-examination. Just reading it is not going to make you a good cross-examiner.
What's the biggest misconception about you that you found?
Well, I think it goes with the territory, but the remark I would most often hear from new acquaintances after we'd been together for an hour or so was, kind of, gee, you're really a nice guy. I hadn't expected that. Because the picture is one of a slashing, angry, scowling cross-examiner beating the witness into a pulp as he cowers on the witness stand, and Hollywood has simply helped that image along. The fact is, we very good cross-examiners very rarely get tough with a witness unless he or she richly deserves it and asks for it.
Is that a feeling of comfort that you're trying to establish in the cross, that the witness becomes comfortable, therefore they might not be so guarded and offer something that can help your client?
Yes, that's certainly one technique. One of the phases of cross-examination, I mean, people think it's all about impeachment and attacking witnesses. It is not. One of the early phases in cross-examination is to get from the witness all of the things that he or she knows that is good, are good, about your case that the other side hasn't developed. For instance, you might want to ask a police officer in a criminal case, isn't it true that the defendant won some medals when serving in the Navy 4 years ago? And that's good stuff for a jury to hear. It's not likely the prosecutor will have brought it out, but if it's true, the police officer pretty usually will say yes.
Joining us with F. Lee Bailey, our great friend Alan L. Morton, attorney at law, and Alan always brags about you. He's met you, and he has some specific questions. Alan?
It's good to talk to you again, Lee. It's been said that people don't believe it if they see it. They see it only if they believe it. So if that's the case, how does the role of cross-examination fit into the so-called truth-seeking process of a trial?
Well, there really is a dual responsibility. One is to get at what the witness really knows and may be willing to lie about unless guided forcefully along the road. And the other is to make sure that the jury understands what the witness has said. And this sometimes requires, although I don't like the process, the old adage that teachers rely on. Tell them what you're going to say, then say it, then tell them what you said. And somewhere along the line it will stick. It all depends to a large extent on the intellect of the jury. If you've got a military jury, they've all been to college, they're pretty smart, there's no point in trying to paint a picture three times. But if you've got a rural jury with not many high school educated members on it, you have to go slow and be as graphic and explicit as you can and often be repetitive.
How does one find a good lawyer, sir?
That is the biggest mystery in the world. The first place you look is lawyers, because lawyers know who the good trial lawyers are. One of the tests that I always use when coming into a new community would be to say to someone who was a practitioner, not necessarily a superstar, if you were in really deep trouble, which, if any, of the local members of the bar would you hire and be comfortable with as your chief counsel? And you begin to dredge up names and reputations in that way. For me, the most direct way is to sit and talk with a lawyer. If he's a good trial lawyer, it'll be sticking out all over him, subconsciously perhaps, after 30 minutes.
Of course, that's billable hours.
A lot of trial lawyers don't work for billable hours. Many of them work on a contingent fee in personal injury and wrongful death. Many of them work on a flat fee in criminal cases. If you don't get it up front, you probably never will. And, of course, those working on billable hours have a different motive than those who are not. The longer they can drag a case out, the more billable hours be brought to the attention of the client.
What other goals do you have or objectives in mind when you cross-examine a witness, Lee? You mentioned impeachment as one of them. What other goals and objectives do you have?
Well, first of all, people must understand that witnesses are trying to emulate a videotape recorder, and that's a tall order. They can't see everything at once, and they can't remember it. So you've got to explore the process with this witness as to this event, as to how the memory was created. And that begins with perception. What did you hear? That's usually the first introduction to an event, because hearing works over 360 degrees horizontally and vertically. Then what did you see. And by that, you really mean, what did you perceive? You can see 180 degrees from your 90 on either side of your nose. You can only perceive in an arc of 5 to 10 degrees, and people can be talked into thinking they saw things they didn't. Then the question is, why did you remember this? If it was your mother's funeral, of course you would. If it's what you had for breakfast a year ago, that's suspicious unless it's tied to another event. Then how well have you remembered? Every prosecutor in the case, or every plaintiff's lawyer, and every lawyer for every side, and a horde of investigators have all been trying to get you to remember a story favorable to them. How have you been able to resist that? And the last thing that they have to do is to articulate with accuracy the picture in their mind that they carried forward perhaps for several years from the date of the incident that's being litigated.
More coming up with F. Lee Bailey, Kevin Miller in the Morning, 580 KIDR, our great friend Alan L. Morton, attorney at law with us. Excellence in Cross-Examination is Mr. Bailey's new book.
Your trust every morning. Kevin Miller, 580 KIDO, Idaho's first radio station.
Up all night.
Good morning. Thank you for listening to 580 KIDO, home of Kevin Miller in the Morning. Alan L. Morton, attorney at law with us. Why? Because we have a very special guest with us, attorney F. Lee Bailey, author of the new book, Excellence in Cross-Examination. Mr. Bailey, we've got to ask you, and I'm sure you talk about this in the book, O.J. Simpson's victory, and when everybody had the goods on him, he was innocent. How did that happen?
Well, I don't talk about the book because I've written a very extensive chapter in that. It's at my website, Bailey and Elliott. People that are really interested in what did happen in the Simpson case, and more importantly, what did not, can read it. It's a very reliable, factual account, and I think the most interesting segment, it describes all the evidence we couldn't put in because we were losing our jury to illnesses, and had we lost the jury, there would have been a mistrial. The prosecution, as a good indicator that they knew they had a crummy case, refused to go along with less than 12 jurors, and had they agreed to go along, we could have gotten down to 6 and still finished the trial. But there are a number of cases, some mine, some done by other lawyers, where the cross-examination is detailed. And by that, I mean hic verba, which is Latin for word. And then I make comments in the form of footnotes on what I believe the lawyer was doing. In my case, I know what I was doing, and whether it worked or not. And this is one of the best ways for young lawyers who can't always arrange to get to sit in what we call the second chair in a good trial and learn from a senior colleague. This is the second best way of learning. Study actual cross-examinations. I think there are 7 in this book, and we'll add another one every year.
But what about the cross-examination of Furman? Was everything on the line then?
Well, it was. I only had one objective where Furman was concerned. I had a mole in the prosecution who told me they were taking him in the grand jury room at night and trying to train him to say yes when I asked him if he ever used the N-word. And so my job was to get him so worked up that despite this training, he could not say yes, he would lie about it, because I knew, and this is before the tapes were discovered, I knew I had plenty of evidence that he used that word viciously and frequently. And so the objective was get Furman to deny that he ever, within 10 years, used the N-word. We couldn't go more than 10 years because 11 years back, he'd signed an affidavit saying how much he hated the N people and that he needed to be retired on a pension because he was burned out. Judge Ito found that to be too stale, conveniently, and so said you're limited to 10 years, and that's why my questions were directed at the last 10 years. And sure enough, Furman took the bait, said no, he was a cook goose from that point forward.
What was that like working with the Dream Team and the late Johnny Cochran?
Working with Johnny Cochran was great. There was no Dream Team, not by a long shot. There were some good lawyers there. There were some who weren't particularly good. There were too many of them by far. The trial dragged on for 9 months. It was not worth three in most jurisdictions. And I would say that the entire experience, which had its moments, like the acquittal, was generally unpleasant.
Alan L. Morton, you have a question for Mr. Bailey.
How do you prepare for cross-examining, Lee? We consider you in our trade as a virtuoso attorney. We'd like to hear from you as to what you do to prepare.
And certainly they're applicable to people that aren't lawyers as
Absolutely,
well.
Because when you're talking about the business environment, preparing for a conference, maybe even an adversary.
Or a presentation, yeah.
Exactly.
Well, the answer is you do everything under the sun. There is an extensive chapter in the book on preparation because, as Melvin Belli, a famed tort lawyer out in California, once said, if your investigator is good enough, most any lawyer will do. And while that, like a lot of what Mel said, and he was a good friend of mine, was an exaggeration, there is a lot of truth in it, because if you've got the facts on your side, you don't have to be handsome or swashbuckling or look like a movie star. You're going to win the case most of the time. So you dig, you look under rocks, you interview everyone you possibly could, sometimes more than once, and try to get the facts down on the one hand that favor your case, and try to get enough facts, not on paper, but in your memory, to take apart any witness who could do you substantial damage.
And, of course, if not, just Google a lot and do your own research. So, in other words, be prepared.
Be prepared, and that means it was best put by my mentor when I was young. He was the cock of the walk in criminal law. His name was Edward Bennett Williams. I had lunch with him the day after I took the bar and months before I was admitted, but I'd tried to quit him a few cases in the military, even though I hadn't been to law school. And I said, Mr. Williams, sometimes you seem to pull a rabbit out of a hat. How do you do that? He said, you come prepared with 50 rabbits and 50 hats, and you get very lucky.
Mr. Bailey, a final thought. We started this interview at 580KIDO when you said that if you had to do it all over again, you wouldn't have been a lawyer. You would have thought about it more than that. But, I mean, you've been successful. You're famous. You've been a part of American history, not only legal history, but American history. Why the regret?
Well, the regrets are several. First of all, I think I was not treated very well by the bar, but I will survive that. And at the end of the day, I'll write about it. And hopefully that's where history will notch the events. But quite a bit beyond that, the practice of law has changed drastically. The public defender was thought to be a great addition to the legal system. It hasn't worked out that way. Public defenders are people that often can't get better jobs elsewhere. They're totally overloaded. They're not well experienced. They don't get the help in the form of investigators and experts and scientific evidence that they need. And I think the telling symbol of that is of the 13 people found to be innocent but sitting on death row in Illinois, all had been represented by a public defender. Almost all were minorities. Their trials had been skimpy, and they were saved from execution only by DNA. So I think a system that's been watered down that bad is not to be admired or chased. If we would go to the British system, where you prosecute one day, defend the next, and trial lawyers are specially certified and recognized, I think we could cure a lot of that. Here in Maine, for instance, there is no public defender system. The judge appoints a lawyer, and usually a competent one, who doesn't get the best of all worlds, but gets more help than public defenders, say, for instance, in New York City.
Boy, that's incredible when you you think about it. The best legal system money can buy, and you take a look at some big major cases. You look at the Duke lacrosse case. If those guys didn't have competent trial, competent counsel, what would have happened to them?
That's right, and it's a shame because I think capital cases should have their own bar, lawyers that are authorized to try capital cases, simply because mistakes by lawyers are fatal to the client. When they're discovered years later, as often happens through DNA or some other revelation, it's kind of tough to go to the graveside and tell the client, oh, boy, we have a new trial order. If only you could attend. So that's a miserable part of the system. I think capital lawyers should be specially chosen from the very top ranks, well paid for what they do, because it would save money in the end and make damn sure that we don't execute innocent people.
Excellence in cross-examination. Mr. Bailey, thank you, sir.
All right. Nice talking with you.
All right. We appreciate that. Before we go, Alan L. Morton, attorney at law, this is one of your heroes. What are your thoughts?
Well, when I was a young man, I read Mr. Lee's book, The Defense Never Rests. It was one of the precipitating factors in the decision I made that I set a goal to go to law school. And so
he said he wouldn't do it again. What about you?
Well, the practice of law has truly changed.
Yes or no?
I have raised five children, and each of them have followed their mothers.
Is this the courtroom or is this the courtroom of public opinion? Yes or no? Mr. Bailey didn't have a problem saying he wouldn't do it again.
I have mixed emotions. I haven't made up my mind, but I will say this, that my children have seen the sacrifices that I've had to make along the way to bring justice on behalf of clients. And it's not, if you think this is a 5-day 9-to-5 job, you're sadly mistaken.
All right. Some words of inspiration from Alan L. Morton, attorney at law. We appreciate that, sir.
You're very welcome.
All right. You're listening to Kevin Miller, 580 KIDO.
Sean Hannity, weekdays at 3. Now, back to Kevin Miller on 580 KIDO, Idaho's first radio station.
All right, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the first day of January for most of us coming back to work. But Dave Burnett was with us last week. Dave, good morning.
Good morning, Kevin.
I know you have a lot of gloating to do, so, you know, this is the Manly Man segment, so I suppose we should get that out of the way.
No gloating.
Where I will say I was wrong.
What?
And you
what?
Were right.
Ray, could we save that clip, please, where Kevin Miller humbly says he's wrong. I said to you back in September, and I wish I would have saved the audio, because at this point you're going to say, did you really say that? I said, I'm glad there's a playoff system now, because it will expose the SEC, that Southeast Conference, the football powers, it will expose them for what they are, overrated.
Well, I don't know how you could say they're overrated when they did get a team, the number one team in the country, into the college football playoff. It just didn't work out for them.
Yeah. How many bowl games did the SEC win?
Well, Dave, I will tell you that, as I've said before, I'm not a sports guy. So,
conveniently today, huh?
I would say, and it has been very popular in the sports media world, the SEC West, long touted this season and every other as the toughest conference in college football, went 2-5 in the bowls.
Ow. Ooh, ow. You know what I'm thinking.
Notice what glee he has.
No, Glee's a really bad show on Fox. You know what it tells me? I'm thinking maybe the SEC might not want to book Appalachian State and Western Carolina Community College. Why don't you go ahead and book some Division I schools to play?
Wow. It's not like everybody does the same thing.
No, everybody doesn't do what the SEC does, Kevin.
Hmm.
If you look at the schedules, if you look at Alabama's schedule, how many cupcakes are on that schedule? There's 2, maybe 3 per season?
Well, I think it depends on the conference. If you're in a cupcake conference, you have to schedule some games that give you a break.
So you're saying the SEC is in a cupcake conference?
I'm saying the SEC is, you can say what you want, and whether it's hype or being overrated, the bottom line was you had three teams in the top four. Okay, it didn't work out that way. That's why they play the games.
Exactly.
But, I mean, at the time when you're playing, when you're, number one is playing number four, you need a break because you wouldn't get into the playoffs. I mean, the SEC has to look at themselves with egg on their face because they were the ones that were pushing for the college football playoff.
Because they thought they would get at least two teams in the playoff.
They did.
And then they thought they'd dominate and the championship game would be between two SEC teams. That's what they thought. See, they believe their own press clippings.
Well, I will tell you, and I wish you were in on this conversation. My father-in-law was visiting us over Christmas, and he had his buddy Mike in. And
what city are they from?
McCall.
Okay.
So he was telling me how great Urban Meyer was, Mike was, and I said...
Coach of the year? Urban Meyer, that guy?
I said, you know something? We ran him out of Florida, and we're going to run him out of Ohio State. And I was wrong. But I saw what they did. I saw what Alabama did to Florida, giving him that heart attack and everything.
Mm-hmm.
It was Urban Meyer's day.
I think Urban Meyer should be coach of the year.
And I do think that Nick Saban did one of the best coaching jobs in the country. That Alabama team, taking nothing away from everybody else, was not the Alabama teams of old. So, unfortunately, that didn't work out for me. I'm still wearing my Alabama hoodie today in honor of them.
Which is good. Stay loyal to your team.
I do stay loyal, but as you know, I am a committed front runner. And my new team, of course, this year was Oregon. And people were saying, well, you know, what happens if Ohio State beats Alabama? I go, well, I grew up in Ohio, so I win. The only time I lose is if Florida State would win.
And
so it's Oregon versus Ohio State. A great matchup for the network. By the way, did you know those games were the highest rated thing ever on cable? I think Ohio State, Alabama had 28.3. Oregon, Florida State had 28.2.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it'll be, and mind you, I lived in Eugene. I used to go to the Duck games all the time, Rich Brooks in that era. I went to Oregon State, so there's a natural hatred for, you know, Oregon in my blood because I'm a Beaver, but, boy, I'd hate to be Ohio State right now because Oregon's hitting on all eight cylinders.
Did you hear about the Oregon, Ohio is going to change its name for a day?
Yes. There is an Oregon, Ohio, and they're changing their name. So, yeah, because they don't want to be related to Oregon when Ohio State plays. But looking forward to it. That'll be fun. You know, the playoffs, and I did say in September it'll show the SEC. It'll expose them. And I think it did. I think it did. I think if you had an eight-team playoff, it would expose them.
Well, I can't disagree because I was right or I was wrong, and Dave Burnett was right.
Again. And Boise State did very well.
And I got to tell you something. You know me. You and I disagree on Boise State.
Mm-hmm.
I had my friend Wendy at the Fred Meyer come up to me. I was wearing my Oregon colors, and she goes, so you cheering for the team? I go, no, I'm not cheering for them. And you know something? I think Coach Harsin is living his dream. Mad props to him. Not that he really cares what I say to that team. Good for them. But to me, it's kind of like everybody, and maybe it's just from a business perspective, instead of really, I don't know, doing things on your own, they glom on to the Broncos. Well, I'm the Broncos this. I'm the Broncos that. Well, good for you. What? Tell me about your customer service.
There's a marketing issue with the Broncos. I mean, they should be selling that stadium out. It should be sold out. You have one of the top teams in the nation right here. They, you know, ask the folks in Arizona, they'll tell you, whoops, maybe they're better than we thought.
Now, was that story really true?
Which one's that?
The one where everybody got on the internet and said, I told you I didn't think it was true.
No, I reportedly, I put it online. Yes, and if you look at my wording, I said he reportedly said this. I never said he said it.
You should your journalism card should be taken away from you.
No, absolutely not. He reportedly
said
it.
Well, let me finish here.
Okay.
Man, I can tell you missed me.
I did.
So the Rich Rodriguez... allegedly said Boise State, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And then a cheerleader was fired.
Yeah, they added that in the mix. That was good.
And, you know, it's kind of like these bogus stories on the internet. The tragedy that happened near Coeur d'Alene, where you had the 2-year-old who killed his mom in the Walmart.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, somebody's telling me, oh, the 2-year-old is being held, is going to get the death penalty, and is being held.
Who told you that?
Just somebody came up to me. Well, it was on Facebook. And these idiots start creating these fake news stories,
mm-hmm.
and that the kid is being held at a maximum security I mean, it's and then they had some clown, I'm a liberal talk show host, who was quoted in the story. And if you don't sit there, if it doesn't come from a credible news source, like 580KIDO.com or some of the other sites in town, you just got to wonder. And this whole Rich Rodriguez thing, and you had people, not you, but in this building going, hey, can you believe he said this? And I'm going, I don't believe he said it because it wasn't picked up by a credible source.
Mm-hmm. No, I don't know that he's, you know what? I think he probably believed some of that. I think he probably believed that they were much better in Boise State. I think he probably believed that, Boise State really shouldn't have been in a bowl game, should have been an SEC team. I mean, I think he probably believed all that. I don't think he ever said it.
Well, it goes to show you, how did that Arizona team ever beat Oregon?
I think Arizona wasn't a bad team. I think they had a very young quarterback, and I think he was totally befuddled by what Coach Yates threw at him defensively.
I think if they had a quarterback, they would have...
It would have made a difference.
Yeah, I think so.
Would have made a difference. But, you know, would they have won? I don't know. You know, they came back, Arizona came back in the second half and shut Boise State down. They made some good adjustments, but Boise State did the same. They came back and shut Arizona down. It went from an offensive game to a very defensive game in the second half. Just Boise State's defense turned out to be better.
Well, we'll see about that with Boise State, how they continue on. And
They got two positions to replace. That's it.
Yeah, but see, for me, the thing with Boise State is that should they have even been in the Big Five Bowl anyway, or the Fiesta Bowl to begin with? I mean, they were ranked number 21, 22.
Okay, Rich Rodriguez, who should have been in then?
I don't know. TCU. TCU played in the Chick-fil-A Bowl, but obviously TCU, Baylor, one of those teams. But, I mean, in the end, they proved they belong because they won.
Mm-hmm.
I give them that, but...
So you're trying to go with the SEC thing of eliminating the Boise States from any bowl games?
I think that I like the old system that you have to be in the top 12.
Mm-hmm.
I think, and again, Arizona proved they were fraud, but if you're competent, you should. I mean, I think for a school outside the Power Five, and they had two losses, that you should be number 12 in the country, something like that. Remember when Utah was the first team to do that? And I know, granted, we live in the age of instant gratification, and that was 27 years ago, even though it was maybe 10, if that. And that whether or not they were going to make it, and it was just the drama of it. And then TCU and BSU going back and forth, and who's going to be the higher seed. But, I mean, if somebody's East Carolina, Marshall, and Boise State, who are they going to pick with that? They're going to pick Boise State.
Yeah, Marshall's not going to do it because they were kind of a fraud. You know, the same argument Boise State used to have, Marshall was, you know, that argument of who'd they really play.
Right.
TCU would be the question mark, with Boise State. But I think that was blown all the way around. I think TCU should have been in one of the four.
Well, and that there goes the drama. Will the Big 12 expand? Because I think that way they were putting it to the Big 12 saying, Hey, guys, you need to have a conference championship like everybody else.
Yeah, and the question then is, if they expand, who do they expand to? Do they take Houston? Do they take a Boise State? Do they take, you know, East Carolina? Who do they take?
Well, there's Cincinnati out there as well.
There is Cincinnati as well. You know, Boise State would like to be there. The BYU question is there, but then there's a question, would they play other sports on a Sunday? Which BYU would not, but would they accept it? You know, is Salt Lake a big enough TV market? Boise State's problem is not their football. It's not their basketball. It's that they'd have to add baseball. And then the other question is the size of the TV market.
That and the money.
Yeah. I don't think the money's an issue. I think if it came to that, you'd see the money coughed up right away. I think you'd see the people eliminated who would need to be eliminated, who would be requested to be eliminated, and we'll just leave it at that. The football program, that's not an issue. The basketball program, that's not an issue. They'd have to add baseball, and the TV market would be a big question. Is the TV market big enough for a conference to pick them up? So, I don't know.
Now, do you have that all out of your system yet?
Sure.
Who are you going in the championship game?
Oregon.
Oh, yeah.
Not even a question.
Hmm.
Not even a question. They're hitting on all eight. And then, to close out, NFL football yesterday, did you watch that Dallas game?
Oh, I did. I did.
DeMarcus Lawrence, former Boise State Bronco, goes from goat to hero. Right at the end of the game, for those who don't know, Detroit's driving. They're trying to score to win the game. DeMarcus Lawrence picks up a fumble and then tries to run with it and then fumbles it back to Detroit. Goat, off to the sideline he goes. But then they bring him back in and causes a fumble and then recovers a fumble. They win the game. So.
Right, but Dallas shouldn't have won that game anyway.
Why is that?
Because they're cheaters.
How are they cheaters?
Because the officials blew the call on the pass interference.
So
play.
One play makes the whole game?
If you know, you've kind of, this has been like the Dave Burnett show.
Absolutely, because I've worked the past 2 weeks.
Well, good for you. I didn't. So, but back to my point here, if I may.
Sure.
It's that pass interference play was horrific. Dez Bryant runs on the field yelling at a call. The NBA has infiltrated the NFL. I mean, look, the fix was in. Dallas had to be propped up to make it there. There's no way. I've never seen in my 47 years of watching, soon to be 47 years of watching football, where you had a play where it was so blatant, they marked it off, then they colluded, and then they waved off the penalty with no explanation. Not one explanation. Mike Herrera on Fox said it was pass interference. Can't tell me that. And then Dez Bryant, I mean, the NFL is on its way to becoming a hoodlum league where you have players running out, getting an official's face. That can't be tolerated. It's like Jameis Winston when he grabbed the referee. Something has to be sacred. And you can't tell me that Dallas, and on their winning drive, go Romo, every time the Detroit players touched the Dallas receivers, it was pass interference.
Is Ray Amaya standing up screaming at you yet?
That's the facts.
Because he's been a Dallas fan since he was a small child.
And that's great. But they were propped up yesterday. Do you not agree with that? Those were not bad calls?
I know that.
No. Those were, do you agree with that call?
Well, I don't like Dez Bryant coming on the field at all.
Do you agree with that call? That pass interference, waving it off. Was that not pass interference?
It appeared to be, but you know what?
It appeared to be. What are you reporting it allegedly?
You could call holding on every play. You could probably call pass interference
on
95%.
Right, right. When have you ever seen that type of play happen where they marked it off and then they waved it off with no explanation?
What you're saying?
Number one. Number two. Hold on. Yeah. Number two. No. You dominated this segment. Number two, where a player comes on the field and starts yelling at an official.
And I just told you I disagreed with that. But.
What do you mean you disagree with that? So, I mean, that is not wrong? So you just kind of wave it off?
I am just saying that one play.
Two plays.
Even
two
that.
Plays. And then the plethora of pass interference penalties called against Detroit?
Do I get a talk?
Now you know how I felt this entire dang segment. Hmm? Answer the question.
Welcome back, Kevin. I got to do traffic. It's that time.
Glenn Beck, weekdays at 9. Now back to Kevin Miller on 580 KIDO, Idaho's first radio station.
Very wet and icy road conditions today. Please be very careful. Let's get the latest traffic. 5:59, Kevin Miller in the morning. Coming up, remembering sports great Stuart Scott. Certainly a man who crossed from sports to news. We'll document his historic fight and mourn his loss next.